Okay, we'll bring the meeting, the Public Safety Policy and Finance Committee to order and start out with a roll call.
Cornish.
Here.
Woodard.
Here.
Mullery.
Here.
Gothier.
Here.
Grunhagen. Hilty. Johnson.
Here.
Kelly. Kiefer.
Here.
Kreisel.
Here.
Leidiger.
Here.
Mariani. McDonald.
Here.
Moran.
Here.
Nornis.
Here.
Slocum.
Okay, thank you. The approval of the minutes from the previous meeting. Does somebody want to move the minutes?
So moved.
Who said that? Oh, there we go. Kreisel. Representative Kreisel moves the minutes. No additions or corrections. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Today we have the Department of Public Safety in front of us, and we'll start out with the overview with Commissioner Ellison. Welcome, and if you want to state your name and title.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Public Safety. As most of you know, Governor Dayton appointed Mona Doman as Commissioner of Public Safety. She will not begin with the department until March 1st, and so she sends her regrets this morning that she was not able to be here. What we're going to do this morning, we have the division directors that are part of the Public Safety Division that you all oversee here today, and I'm going to go over some brief comments overall about our budget, and then as we get to each division, I'll ask the division directors to come up and give a brief overview of their divisions and then answer your questions. The mission of the Department of Public Safety is to protect citizens and communities, prevent, prepare, respond, recover, educate, and enforce, focus on saving lives, providing efficient, effective services, and maintain the public trust and developing strong partnerships. Public safety divisions that are under the purview of this committee include the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division, Office of Justice Programs, the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Emergency Communication Networks, and the State Fire Marshal. Our 2012 and 2013 base budget includes the following: $130,643,000 in state government special revenue. That's 42% of our budget. Miscellaneous special revenue is $18,778,000. That's 6%. General fund is $156,530,000, or 51%. And 1% comes from the Trunk Highway Fund, and that totals $3,882,000. The 12-13 projected expenses by category include the following: 21% of our money is transferred to other state agencies. That's $66,564,000. Total compensation is $69,329,000, or 22%. Local assistance is $90,394,000, or 30% of our budget. And operating expenses that include all of the other expenses, rent, supplies, everything like that, is $83,546,000, or 27%. So the total of all funds for the biennium for 2012 and 13 for public safety divisions is $309,833,000. The State Fire Marshal's Office, I'm going to ask Director Rosendahl to come forward and talk a little bit about what the State Fire Marshal does. But their mission is to protect lives and property by fostering a fire-safe environment.
Director, go ahead and state your name and title. And
good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Jerry Rosendahl, State Fire Marshal. The State Fire Marshal Division, or the Office of State Fire Marshal, actually was created in 1905. The original charges we were given had to do with fire investigations and fire reporting. Since that time, a number of things, of course, have been added, including adoption, enforcement of the state fire code, inspections of schools, daycares, motels, hospitals, nursing homes, correctional facilities. And we also are involved in licensing, certification, and other miscellaneous programs dealing with explosives, fireworks, cigarettes, public education, and fire sprinklers. Our funding is provided by approximately 70%. It's provided by the fire safety account, a new fund that was created and started July 1 of 2007. The other 30% come from other special revenues, from inspection fees, and also contracts. Through the fire safety account, just a couple of items that I want to mention. We developed the Minnesota Fire Incident Reporting System to be online. This is a free online service to all fire departments, and the significance of that is that it eliminates the need for local fire departments to have to contract for software package, maintenance, and upkeep from a commercial vendor. And this has been received very well, and our reporting percentage has gone up tremendously. We're very near 100% of all 785 fire departments reporting to us through electronic means. And this is a very high number compared to many other states. There's some states who receive 50% or less of the fire departments report into the system. Of course, it's much easier when you have 100% of the data to be able to analyze how to deal with investigation, enforcement, regulation, the whole public education issue, because what we learn off those fire reports are turned right around back into code enforcement, public education, and the various issues that we deal with. Our staff, unlike some, are predominantly located in home offices, which are spread throughout the state, and they're assigned territory around that home office or a regional area. And that applies to the 21 inspectors and the 11 or 12 investigators that are out there, which obviously results in quick service since they're right in that area. They also have developed over the years very excellent relationships with local fire departments and police departments, sheriff's departments, and emergency managers, and also provide a number of training opportunities since our people are, I'm a little slightly prejudiced, but our people in terms of code enforcement, inspections, knowledge of investigations are, I believe, the experts in the state, and they do a lot of training at the local level to try to support their needs. So that's kind of a quick overview on the State Fire Marshal Division. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Mullery, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair. I was just trying to get in before you brought up the next group because I didn't get my hand up quick enough on the last issue. So after fire is over.
Representative Leidiger. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes, sir. Okay. Mr. Chairman, I just, since the state fire marshal is up here, I just wanted to say my house was burnt down on 9/11 in 2009. And I could not believe the speed at which the fire marshals made it to the place. I mean, it was still burning, and they were there. And the amount of, and the number of fire marshals in training in the local levels, the volunteer police departments, they were all so very much aware, and they were there to go ahead and cordon off the scene and things like that. Your training program is amazing, and this, I live way out in the country, so this is all volunteer for us. So I just needed to put in that plug. Great guys, great organization.
Thank you, Representative. Always good to get a kudo, Director, right?
Excellent. Love those.
All right. Any more questions from the members? Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Rosendahl. I had a quick question about the fire safety account. Is that the fee that we see on our homeowners insurance?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is I think it's a 0.65 percentage, a percent of the homeowners insurance, and that does go into that fire safety account, yes.
Okay. A follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Woodard.
Yep. Mr. Rosendahl, is that traditionally been an issue with us taking that and putting that in the general fund? Are there any funding issues associated with the fire safety account?
Mr. Rosendahl.
Mr. Chair and members, when the account was originally created, starting on July 1, 2007, it replaced another fee that was paid by the insurance industry, and it was going into, at that time, the general fund. So initially, to start off, there was, I think it's $2.268 million that comes out of that account right off the top or first to go to the general fund. Since that time, the legislature has added some additional transfers out of that account to the general fund. The current 10-11 biennium, I think the number is about $10.5 million.
Thank you, Representative Woodard. And a good question, because we'll be getting into that specific area in depth with quite a lot of testimony probably in the coming weeks. And you'll be hearing probably from your fire chiefs and departments and lobbyists about this issue, because it's a huge fund that's been, I think it was Session 06 it was created, and then a lot of money was appropriated, and we had to take some of it to balance the budget, so it caused a lot of ire, and but we'll be looking into it. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rosenthal, excuse me, is this the fund that is allocated for some local communities to apply for grants for their training and needs as well?
Mr. Chair and members, that is correct. There's three designated purposes in the law for that fire safety account. One is funding for our office. The second major category is funding the Minnesota Board of Firefighter Training and Education, where local fire departments can apply for grants out of that fund. And then the third category is regional response teams. The Fire Service Advisory Committee, which is set up to kind of have oversight over that committee, that fund, and then make recommendations to the Public Safety Commissioner on how to spend it, have allocated several million dollars to local fire departments over the three rounds that we've gone through since the inception of the account.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you.
Right. Questions from any more members? Well, thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Who we have next? Is it going to be Mr. Arlt?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Mullery had a question.
Okay, Representative Mullery.
Before you bring the next one up. I had a couple questions. The transfer funds, could you briefly, what is that as far as, is it, somebody said it's federal, something else? Could you describe that a little more? And there's also, at one time there was a prison subcommittee that I was on, and there was a lot of money that was not bonding money, but department money going into upgrading prisons and things like that. So where does that come in?
Ms. Ellison, as long as on that one, and when you're finished with that one, why don't you hit the other categories there too? We got a lot of new members and total compensation, local assistance, somebody might not know what that entails. So after you're done answering Representative Mullery's question on that category. So.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, when it comes to bonding money for upgrading prisons, I think that would be more appropriately directed to corrections. I'm not aware of that within public safety.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Mullery?
And I don't know, this is several terms ago. I know that at that time there was money from DPS that was not through the bonding bill, but was for problems with the facilities at the prisons. So it was not in the bonding committee. It was somehow taken care of by DPS. And I just wondered what that came under or how that is.
Commissioner Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, I'm not familiar with that history. I'd have to ask people back at the agency and get back to you.
No, I'm not familiar with it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe I can.
Representative Mullery?
It goes from, maybe it's included in maintenance. It was things like I remember them telling us that, for instance, the electronic system for gates had, going in and out had to be changed or something. They didn't get bonding money for that. Is that, but they were paying it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery,
is that considered operating then or something?
That would be considered a transfer to another state agency for their purpose, unless we issued it by way of grants.
So but that would be in transfer then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller,
Mr. Ellison.
If I'm understanding your question correctly, that it was general fund money that was appropriated to the Department of Public Safety for improving the prisons, then we would have transferred that to the Department of Corrections or issued it by way of grants. But if what you're describing is the way it happened, then that would be included in a transfer to another state agency.
Representative
Mueller. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I'll clear that up later. I think you're
okay. Thank you.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, could Representative Mueller still explain the transfer and what you asked her to explain to? Mm-hmm.
Commissioner Ellison, maybe you're going to answer that further. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when it comes to transfers to other agencies, Mr. Boydum will get us that detail, and I can provide that to the committee at a later time. We're thinking at this point that it has to do with the emergency communications network system, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes.
Commissioner Ellison, total compensation, local assistance, and operating, if you just maybe a few sentences about each one, what that means.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, local assistance are grants that we send out to local units of government and not-for-profit agencies. And then the other operating expenses is everything that it takes to run the agency other than compensation, so rents, special supplies, and all of those sorts of things.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mullery.
I just remembered that I rephrased that, or I phrased the wrong instance. What I remember at that time, DPS was involved with some of the what might be labeled intelligence, gathering information on, for instance, on what prisoners said and getting it to law enforcement back then. So maybe that's what I was thinking of back at that time. That's like 12 years ago or something, so maybe everything's changed.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Next, who do we have up?
The next division is alcohol and gambling, and their mission is to maintain the integrity of legalized gambling, detect and vigorously pursue illegal forms of gambling, enforce the state's liquor laws, and monitor state-tribal gaming compacts.
Good morning. You want to state your name and title and go ahead with your presentation.
My name is Jim Arlt. I'm the interim director for the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. Chairman Cornish and representatives of the Public Safety Committee, as part of our mission to maintain the integrity of legalized gambling, we've conducted over 8,400 background fingerprint check submissions that were processed in 2010. We also conducted 22,000 preliminary and comprehensive background investigations and criminal history or criminal record checks on alcohol and gambling licenses and contracts in 2010. As far as criminal investigations, we received over 25,000 complaints that totaled over 880,000 regarding our fraud scams underneath our lottery and sweepstakes fraud program. Approximately 190,000 of that was intercepted and returned to the victims, and criminal investigations are occurring in three different countries. Over 90,000 complaints have been received by us in our lottery and sweepstakes fraud program since the fall of 2007 when we started that initiative. Our agency also conducted 281 gambling-related investigations involving thefts from lawful forms of gambling, cheating in the card rooms, and illegal gambling. We also conducted 14 corporate background investigations for companies that wished to be involved in lawful forms of gambling in Minnesota. We also conducted numerous slot machine and blackjack inspections at the tribal casinos. Our alcohol enforcement activities would involve, we administer a federal enforcing underage drinking law program grant. In fiscal year 2010, approximately 2,400 liquor licensees, bartenders, local law enforcement officers, and community officials attended and successfully completed an agency-sponsored responsible alcohol server training course, which was offered 98 times throughout the state of Minnesota. We also began our retail alcohol vendor enforcement program to work in conjunction with the State Patrol and local law enforcement authorities to reduce the incidence of over-serving and also to take civil actions against retail multiple offenders. In fiscal year 2010, RAVE was active in 10 counties and 110 cities. There was 370 in-person visits that were conducted at liquor license establishments, and 90 case files were established for possible civil penalties. 11 warnings were issued, and only 17 fines were issued for sales or service to obviously intoxicated individuals. The goal of this program, in conjunction with the State Patrol and local law enforcement, is to reduce the number of DWI accidents that occur. We also approve and issue alcohol and gambling distributor, manufacturer and gambling device, and alcoholic beverage, wholesale, import, retail, liquor licenses and permits. We regulate approximately 17,000 distributors and manufacturers of gaming devices and alcoholic beverages, as well as importers and retailers of alcoholic beverages. We collect just under $2.5 million in license fees in the last fiscal year, which do go into the general fund, I believe. And we are responsible for the collection of an estimated approximately $13 million in delinquent liquor sales taxes annually by investigating liquor licensees who are on the liquor posting list and enforcing violations of buying at retail for resale. We have approximately 20 full-time equivalent or full-time positions in our agency. That will be down to either 18 or 19 by the end of this fiscal year. And I'd like to end up thanking you for the opportunity to speak to this committee and open for as far as any questions that you may have.
First one for me, what kind of a luck have you had in compliance with the state tribal compacts, and what kind of authority or jurisdiction do you have when you check these out as far as getting information? How much information can you get if you go into depth a little bit more on that?
Our state tribal compacts were typically negotiated back in about the late 1980s to early 90s, depending upon the compacts. We are limited as far as jurisdiction to what is in the compact, which ends up allowing us to go in, inspect the slot machines or gaming devices that are in play there. We end up checking for what's called approved programs, which are approved through an independent testing lab. And then we also end up, as far as on the blackjack side of things, we can break down their decks. We can look for surveillance requirements that are listed in the compact. But as far as our actual jurisdiction and oversight, it is limited by what is in the compact, and we're not similar as far as into a New Jersey or Nevada type of regulatory oversight.
Okay, thank you, sir. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ault, is it pronounced?
Yes.
If Racino becomes a reality, what's the impact, if any, it'll have on your department?
Well, we would be happy to end up drawing up a fiscal note, Chairman Cornish and representatives. I'm not used to some of the formalities. But it would end up having an impact as far as manpower that would be needed. There are a lot of different slot machine cheating groups that go around, not only our country, but other countries. There are incidents then, obviously, that we would end up having to investigate. You also have thefts and stuff that can occur and do occur from inside of the casinos, from casino employees, that we would end up probably investigating underneath our jurisdiction.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question, Mr. Ault, if I may. Then, based upon other states that have adopted this, can you gauge any expense at all in doing so?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're not trying to dodge the question, but what happens is that we respond to a fiscal note with a specific bill, because if we start putting out general numbers, then if something in the bill makes that number incorrect, people think that we're sort of messing with the numbers. So what we do is, when there's a specific bill that's proposed and we know what the proposal is, then we are very careful in developing a fiscal note that we think is very accurate.
Representative McDonald?
Mr. Chair, Mrs. Ellingson, then it's safe to say then that if it does become a reality, there is a cost factor to the state in the department. Would that be a fair statement?
Mr. Chair, absolutely there would be a cost. It's just a question of what the bill says, and then we would determine exactly what the cost would be.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You want? Representative Leidiger.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, just briefly, I'm also concerned about the gambling side of your business and the numbers. How many compacts do we have with the, and actually then I want to know how many casinos, and then also do we have any compacts that are in place that are that then are going to be built? That's it. Just trying to get a scope of.
Okay. Mr. Robert?
Chairman Cornish and Representative Lettinger, I believe there are 17 casinos right now. I'd have to go back and check on that. I could go through as far as where they're located in my head and start going through that way. As far as I know, there are not any that are in the process of being built that I've been made aware of. So I'm wondering, am I missing
that anything? Answers my question. I was just trying to get an idea of the scope.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Leidiger. Representative Mullery, followed by Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just one quick question. Racino is kind of a privately run. If there's been talk about having, you know, using the dome for a state-run casino, would that be run by your department then, or who?
Chairman Cornish and representatives, at this point in time, I haven't seen a bill as far as where a casino would be run by our agency.
Representative Mullery?
I didn't know if it had been talked about.
Representative Grunhagen.
Mr. Chair, this is a point of information for Representative McDonald. You know, as far as the cost for the expansion of gambling, I would... I've got some research on my website, glennforstaterep.com, that I took off the internet and put on there. There's been an extensive study on gambling and its social effects, especially in terms of state cost. It's a very poor economic model, gambling, because it does not produce a product or technology that increases gross domestic product. But in that study, it shows that, and this is off the top of my head, for about every $45 of additional revenue that's generated for a state through legalized gambling, the social and societal cost that the state has to pick up is about $250 to $289. So it's a losing proposition as far as state spending the promotion of gambling in a society. And I think that's why historically strong economic countries have dealt with gambling as a vice rather than legalizing it. Just a point of information. And by the way, when you're on my website, you could make a donation if you want.
I'll add a link to mine then.
Yeah. These are all good questions, but we'll get into this. Today we're just on an agency overview, and we'll get into the specifics. I'm sure the Racino bill will come through sooner or later. And Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dahl, just a quick question about your the gambling enforcement piece of it. Is it under your purview to look at pull tabs and those kinds of charity gambling as well?
Chairman Cornish and, I'm sorry, sir, Woodard?
Woodard, yes, sir.
Representative Woodard. Do we look at those? We don't regulate as far as that form of gambling. Where we would get involved would be thefts that occur in that form of gambling.
Okay.
So we would be involved as far as doing criminal investigations at that point in time to determine who exactly is the thief, the dollar lost to the charity, and then present that case to the courts.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from any members? Are you finished with your presentation, Mr. Arp?
Yes, Chair.
All right. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members moving on, I want to point out, too, that we did give you fact sheets on each one of our divisions, so just so you know that they are in your packets. Next area we're going to talk about is Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and their mission is to help Minnesota prevent, prepare for, respond to, and recover from natural and human-caused disasters. And we have Director Idy here to talk about it in further detail.
Good morning, and if you could state your name and title for the record, and go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris Eide. I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. We are currently celebrating our 60th anniversary as a state agency or a division of an agency. We started in 1951 as the Office of Civil Defense, and in 2004 became the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. We are charged with helping the state prepare, respond, recover, and prevent future disasters from any type. We currently have had 12 presidential declarations of either an emergency or a major disaster in the last 5 years. We have a very small general fund budget. We are a very large pass-through division for federal grants, mostly from the Department of Homeland Security and the Federal Emergency Management Agency. We are currently managing about $181 million of federal grants, which also include disaster grants and preparedness grants. We have five divisions, sections within our division. We have Field Services Branch, which takes care of the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act, which is a budget activity that you will be overseeing. We have six regions in the state, and we have regional coordinators in those areas. We have quite an extensive training and exercise program in our Field Services Branch, and we work with the volunteer agencies that are active in disaster in our Volunteer and Resource Coordination Group. Our Homeland Security Branch, we deal with the Critical Infrastructure Protection Program. That's making sure that that those parts of the infrastructure are protected. We work with their threat assessment. We work with their security assessment. And then we work with grants to make sure that those companies are protected. 85% of the critical infrastructure in this country are owned by private entities, and this group works in partnership with the private sector. We also have staff in Minnesota Joint Analysis Center, which is actually managed by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. However, we do have staff in there. Our preparedness branch is our emergency planning group. We deal with the Emergency Preparedness and Response Committee, which has a member from every state agency that has been assigned emergency responsibility, and that is also our radiological and emergency preparedness program. Our response recovery mitigation branch takes care of our state emergency operations center, and that's our post-disaster recovery and mitigation programs, and then also our public education campaigns, such as the winter weather awareness campaign and the severe weather awareness campaign and preparedness month. We also have a school safety center, which is a program that is in cooperation with the Department of Education. We provide technical assistance to schools and school districts to work with their emergency preparedness, and we provide quite a bit of training in that area. This past year, we had 61 emergency management and school safety classes, which resulted in 25,000 student contact hours and over 3,000 participants in our training program. A couple of sessions ago, we have a section to our Chapter 12, which is requiring every state agency that has responsibility in the state emergency operations plan to have one certified emergency manager in their agency. This is a 256-hour program that those state employees have to take, and we have 15 of the 22 state agencies in full compliance, and we expect that they will all be in compliance by 2012. One of our large programs we have, which is also another budget activity that this committee will oversee, is our nuclear plant preparedness program. We have two nuclear power generating plants in the state, one in Monticello and one in Red Wing. Every year we are required to have a full-scale emergency exercise, which it takes approximately 500 people to participate at the local and the state level. We also have three hostile action-based tabletops and drills that were that we participated in last year, because the hostile action base is a new requirement from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and from FEMA to ensure that our nuclear power plants are safe from hostile takeover. In that program alone, we trained over 2,100 responders. Another budget activity area we have is a Community Right to Know Act. We have over 6,000 facilities in the state that utilize hazardous materials, and they are required to register with the state, pay a fee, and list the chemicals that are in there so that our first responders can be safe when they go to an emergency at one of those facilities. We had 99% of the agencies that, or the facilities that are required to report, reported in our online database.
Ma'am?
Yes.
Representative Mulliger, do you want to ask a question now before we get too far down the road, or wait till?
Mr. Chairman, it's on the nuclear one, so before we keep going, I'd like to ask a question on that.
Before now or before we go into the next?
Oh, doesn't matter if it's now or before
the
next.
We can ask it now. Go ahead, Representative Mulliger.
Question. I know local communities have complained to some of us about the state. I guess it's not an official mandate. I don't know if it's called an official mandate or an de facto mandate that add to local costs, such as communities near those plants say that they have to have facilities for cleaning off the possible nuclear waste off of cars for the people in the area. Different. There's a lot of things like that. Some are construction of buildings, some are extra equipment, things like that that are thrown on to some of the local communities. It's not the actual city it's in, but some of the surrounding ones. Since we're kind of dumping some extra costs on them, do we have anything to? They were indicating they were having problems; they couldn't find money from state or federal. Do you know if there's anything there for those kind of local communities that we de facto have? It's like a de facto mandate, I guess.
Director Eddy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, it is on a lot of those communities, it is an actual mandate that comes from the federal government. It comes from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and from FEMA. We do have over $4 million every year to run this program. So the communities that have been given responsibility in the State Emergency Operations Plan and have taken on the responsibility in their own emergency operations plan do get reimbursed for the costs of providing that service. We don't build buildings. There is no requirement that they build a building to do some of these things, but they do have to go through training and they have to provide a reasonable assurance that they can protect the public through these exercises. Their time for training is reimbursed. The cost of equipment and supplies to provide that training is also reimbursed for that.
Representative Mulliger?
Well, Mr. Chair, that wasn't exactly what I was getting from certain local communities. They're not. It doesn't affect my district, but some people may want to, especially rural districts out there, may want to look into that.
Okay, Director Eddy, continue.
Thank you. Fire Marshal Rosendahl mentioned earlier about the fire safety account, and he also mentioned the specialized emergency response assets. We do receive a portion of that for our chemical assessment teams and our Minnesota Task Force 1, which is a collapsed structure team to provide emergency response assistance to those local communities that don't have that specialized response. We have 11 chemical assessment teams across the state and one emergency response team that is located in St. Paul. This past year, they went on 26 deployments, And then we also had 23 phone consultations with local incident managers. We had one deployment of the Minnesota Task Force 1, which was to the grain bin accident in the southern metropolitan area earlier this year. We also have four bomb squads, which we have under contract through our general fund appropriation. And this past year, they had 87 deployments, 11 of which were actual bomb-type devices. Nine of those deployments had two or more devices, and one of those deployments actually was discovered over 100 devices, which was a five-day event for them to render that safe. They also had 11 calls for suspicious packages over the last year. This is a very well-trained group of bomb technicians, and we're very proud of the assistance that they give. That's the end of my presentation, barring any questions you may have.
Thank you, Director. Any questions for members? Seeing none, who do we have next? Thank you much.
We have the Office of Justice Programs, and I'm going to ask Director Bovaire to come forward. Their mission is to provide leadership and resources to reduce crime in Minnesota, improve the functioning of the criminal justice system, and assist victims of crime.
Good morning. Yours is going to be an important testimony this year, naturally, because we've looked at your programs in detail over the couple of last bienniums and had a lot of questions. So go ahead with your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jerry Bovaire, and I am the Director of the Office of Justice Programs. The Office of Justice Programs was created in 2003 to better coordinate criminal justice planning activities and grant administration activities. Our budget is approximately 58% federal or state, 40%. Oh, my goodness, I'm confused. It's about, as you can see, our budget is about 34.3 state funds, million in state funds. We administer about $60 million in funds each year, and 58% of that is general fund, 40% is federal, and 2% is special revenue. We have about 40 staff at the Office of Justice Programs in a variety of activities. The first activity you see up there is crime victim reparations. Reparations provides direct compensation to victims of violent crime for their expenses incurred due to that crime. And last year, we opened about 1,800 claims. The second program is the Crime Victim Justice Unit, which provides information and technical assistance and referral assistance to folks who believe their rights have been violated or if they need assistance navigating the criminal justice system. They opened about 74 active investigations in the last 2 years and had over 2,900 contacts. We provide grants to local programs for assistance to crime victims in the areas of general crime, abused children, domestic violence, sexual assaults, and the emergency grant program. We have another division that we've combined the training and communication division with a statistical analysis center, and they do research, training, and communications on behalf of OJP. We also have state-funded justice and community grants that are designed to reduce crime, delinquency, drug abuse, and violence, and we have state and federal funds in this particular pot of money. I could provide significant information on each of the grant programs for you, and I'm sure that you'll want to see that. But for now, I'll just end my presentation and take questions if you have them.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you made a very pointed comment at the beginning of this division overview, and I think that's really a relevant issue because later when we're back and talking more in detail about the budget, 80% of the general funds that we have within the Department of Public Safety go either to the Office of Justice Programs or the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. So if we're talking about any changes in funds, upward, downward, keeping it the same, whatever, we're really talking about programs within the Office of Justice Programs or the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. So I think your comment was right on target.
Yeah, members, you can see the pressure we're under, all of us on both parties, to solve the budget because you'll hear from the fire chiefs about the fire safety account. You're going to hear from battered women and domestic violence centers. They're going to want their funds protected. And so, as I said the other day, whenever we try to save one, we're going to have to dig that much into the other. So it's going to be a an interesting year. Did we have a question over here? I thought I saw a hand. Representative McDonald and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Mrs. or Mrs. Bouvier?
Yes.
Miss. And how do we know that when we address this doesn't say, I've asked that, I was curious, Mrs. or Ms. I mean, just what's the proper etiquette? Ms.? Thank you. Okay, well, just wanted to clarify, what was the federal portion of the budget? I didn't quite hear that clearly.
Mr. Chair and Member, about 40% is federal funds in our budget.
40%.
Correct.
That's all I had. Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director, how much of the federal money is dependent on a state match or ensuring that the state monies are ignored to obtain that federal money?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have several, it's about half and half. Half of the federal funds require some kind of match and the other half require none. And I can provide significant detail to you if you would like that.
And Director, you might answer this already, but how many, remember when you gave us those pages after page of grants that you issued out, about how many line items was there? Different grants that went out in numbers? Not fiscally, I mean a number of grants.
Mr. Chair, we and members, we manage, I think, currently a little over 300 grants total.
Thank you. And Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do the burn grants go to you? And if so, what is expected in the following biennium or in coming biennium?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the burn grants do go through us, and the grant amount is projected to be about $4 million.
Thank you. Any more questions from members? Okay, thank you very much,
Mr. Chairman.
Bouvier, it's pronounced?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
just real quick, is that $4 million per year? Because I asked about the biennium, is it four per year or four for the biennium?
Mr. Chair, members, it's $4 million a year at least projected for fiscal year 11.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Okay, Commissioner Ellison, who do we have now?
The next division is the Emergency Communications Networks. And their mission is to utilize emerging technologies to provide the most comprehensive emergency communication networks available. By developing professional partnerships and collaborating with our customers, we will deliver customer-focused network solutions that enhance public safety. And I'd like to introduce Jackie Mines, the director of that division.
Hey, Director Mines, you would state your name and title again.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jackie Mines. I'm the director of the Emergency Communication Networks Division, called ECN.
Good morning. Go ahead.
The Division of Emergency Communication Networks encompasses two programs that manage two critical public safety communication networks, the 911 network and the Allied Radio Matrix, or ARMR network, which is a statewide shared radio communications network. The Minnesota statewide 911 program costs and the ARMR program costs are funded since 1987 out of the state collecting a 911 fee. That fee is assessed on all wireline, wireless, and VoIP devices that are capable of dialing 911. Those fees are deposited into a special revenue account, and consequently they cover the cost of the program itself. We build out a 911 network across the state. A portion of that is appropriated out to or given out as grant money to each of the 87 counties in the state to run their public safety answering point. And there are, as well as there's the East and West Medical Resource Communication Centers, and then the 911 fee covers the debt service on the revenue bonds sold to construct the ARMR system. And the backbone maintenance and operational costs are covered under that as well. That fee is assessed at 80 cents currently today. The 911 program has recently embarked on building out or upgrading that 911 network to a high-speed data and voice network. We're calling this initiative Next Generation 911. We have completed the first phase of that. which has allowed all of our public safety answering points in the state to be able to transfer calls back and forth with location information and telephone number information that pops up on the screen. I'd like to point out that that is something that is not actually available in most states around the country, so we are far ahead of many of our other states. The Armor system is 61% of that backbone is on the air today, 75% statewide coverage. The Department of Transportation just recently got all of their trucks on the air on that system for the preparation of the winter storms, etc., this year. And we approximately have a third of the counties on air at this time. 71 out of the 87 counties have signed participation plans that identify that they have every intent to go on that system. This is not a mandated system, but there is interoperability between all of the public safety answering points and all of the different divisions and within the state that are on the system or not on the system, and we put together operational standards and training to assist in that endeavor. And I open up for questions.
Mr. Carger, could you go over a little bit of this? Didn't we have some controversy whether we could or couldn't use money out of the 911 surcharge to fund Armor, and how did that turn out?
Mr. Chair, members, I think on the 911 fee, which is, as the speaker said, is about 80 cents right now. I think last year, the budget year, there was somewhat of a surplus, and they were going to use it for two projects, I think, to upgrade some software and some other items. And the question came up, could we take that money and use it for, you know, to help offset our budget deficit? And I would like to also refer to Mr. Diebel, because he also did some research on that, and maybe he could answer the whether it was a yes or a no.
Mr. Diebel?
Mr. Chair and members, the research I conducted showed that several states did use their 911 fee for general fund appropriations. There are statutes in the federal code that say that the money needs to be, that grant states the authority to use to assess a 911 fee, and that they're supposed to use it for 911 purposes. But the as you can see from the Armor program, they use the money for 911, but also for Armor, which is an extension of 911.
Are there any penalties assessed if we just went ahead and
There is the threat from the federal government that they could withdraw your authority to impose a 911 fee. But I'm unaware of any state that's used the money for other purposes and suffered that consequence.
Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Mr. Carger.
Mr. Chair, if I just may expand on this, you brought it up earlier, and I think this is going to be an issue throughout this session, is we have these special revenue funds, and if we get a low target, the question will come up, do we want to take some of the funds and use them to help offset the some of the funding reductions in other agencies? And we have done this in the past with the fire training account that was discussed here earlier. We had, before that, we had authority over an auto theft prevention program. That's a surcharge that goes on your licenses, and that was rated before, too, during 03, and I think still some of that money is going to the general fund. But it, I think this will be an issue, some of these special revenue funds, throughout this session.
There was one other question I had. Commissioner, are you in charge or aware of the hubbub that's going on in Mankato about moving that dispatch point to Rochester and the unhappiness generated because of it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what you're referencing is the State Patrol's plan to merge public safety answering points. I am aware that there has been some consternation on the part of some people regarding that plan. So, yes, I'm aware of it.
If you could, maybe we could have a continuing conversation, because even the people in the state agencies and surrounding agencies aren't too happy about that, and they're questioning the consulting agency's estimate that it was actually going to save money and that it didn't. And I know now we're going to have people dispatching cars in Mankato from Rochester that possibly have never been there or lived in that area, and I know that's possible with all the technology we have, but if we could have a continuing discussion with that here in the next week or so, that'd be great.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to do so.
And Representative Grunhagen.
Mr. Chairman, this is a question for Ms. Ellingson and just for some of the more experienced members on the committee. Is there a mechanism that we have that encourages different departments to look at privatizing services as much as possible in the delivery of their program or their goals, what they're doing? What I mean by that is where we allow a competitive bid on a similar service in these different agencies, and the private sector, generally speaking, tends to be more efficient and less costly, and sometimes in many cases can deliver as good or better results than what government does in particular. Is there any type of mechanism like, because that, the reason I bring that up, after being on the school board for 16 years, we privatized some of our services in the school district. And the result was we had substantial savings in most cases, better service, less complaints, and the district ran much more efficiently. And so when I look at all these different departments, it's just a general comment. Do we have a mechanism that encourages that, or do we do that on a regular basis, or do we just look at delivering these services through government only?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we work with the private sector in a number of different ways. But to first answer your question about a mechanism, certainly we've been given directives before by the legislature to look at particular services and whether they would be more cost effective if we privatize them. So certainly the legislature can ask us to do that in any area. However, we do work with the private sector in a very substantial way. We put out requests for proposal, and we get bids on many, many different types of services. And I'm going to ask Ms. Mines, just in terms of this area, how we work with the private sector in terms of providing the 911 service and the 800 megahertz service, as an example.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 911 network specifically, we do go out to bid for those services. We don't actually run them. We basically manage the contracts to make sure that they meet a certain level of service and respond in an adequate time frame to make sure the network is up and running at all times. And as also for the state radio network build out, that is also purchased through an RFP process. So we do use the competitive bid process, and we do use those private companies that are capable of providing the services.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would also say with the large number of grants that we put out, that really is putting out grant money to the private sector to deliver the services that we don't provide directly through our government agency. A whole lot of what we do is passed through to other agencies to do the work. I hope that's responsive to your question.
Representative Grunhagen?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Ellingson. Yeah, so there is something in place, a directive, or that would encourage that in these different departments? Do I draw that conclusion?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know of any specific directive, but we, just because of the normal mechanisms and the way we do business and the way certain dollars are appropriated, we send them out either through a request for proposal process to businesses or whoever would be appropriate to bid, or through a grant process to private not-for-profit agencies to do the work on behalf of government.
One follow-up question, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Just one, Ms. Ellington, are you aware if there's ever been a work study done on the government departments that you work with? That's where a group of people come in and assess the number of people that you have employed based on the goals and the responsibilities they've had, and to see if you're understaffed or overstaffed. Has something like that ever been done, as far as you know, with government agency, the agencies you work with, or if it has been done, how recently?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do that as sort of as a normal course of our strategic planning processes. But in terms of having somebody come in and look at our whole State Department and say whether you're understaffed or overstaffed, we don't do that. But we regularly benchmark our services through our various divisions to what other people are doing across the nation and the state, if that's appropriate.
So you compare, Mr. Chair, Ms. Ellington, so you have a way of comparing the services you provide with how other states are doing it and also as far as cost?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we do that on an ongoing basis.
Okay, but you haven't had a private work study, Mr. Chair, Ms. Ellingson, you haven't had a private work study done on the agencies?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we have not had have a private group come in and look at that specifically.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Did you have any more testimony?
The only thing I would like to add, Mr. Chair, is we've had a history of using any 911 reserve for grants out to the local units of government so that they can enhance their areas for public safety. And in those cases where 911 funds have been used to be in the general fund, those states have lost their federal funding to support their 911 initiatives. So we would encourage or hope to keep those reserves for public safety use.
I guess I would say to that is we'll do the best we can, but nothing's off the table this year. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next area we're going to mention is the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. You were given a very specific overview last week of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, but Special Agent Knutson and Acting Superintendent Bjerga have some information on the Predatory Offender Program that they would like to present.
Director Bjerga, been a long time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Rather than plow the same ground again that we did last week with our little over an hour discussion, I'd like to address the questions that were brought up by the committee members, if I may.
Yes,
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you.
In regards to your question on the on this internet safety in the schools and whether there is a statewide ability to monitor that or a training program, there is not. At this point, it's up to each individual district. And also, Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, in response to your question regarding comparing our BCA budget breakdown to the states of Indiana and Colorado, I've reached out to my counterparts in those states. I have not gotten back the information. I'm actually going to take another look at Indiana because that's a different model than Minnesota is. Actually, it's a state police system, which we do not have here. I think there'll probably be a better comparison out there somewhere, but I will get you that information also.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Grudy.
Hey, thank you so much for that response. Appreciate your follow-up on that. And, yeah, I'd be very interested in that because my understanding is Indiana and Colorado have similar populations to the state of Minnesota, so it'd be interesting to compare what our costs are, either on a per capita basis or just our overall budgets. And, again, crime can be different in, you know, different states, I understand that. But thank you for that response.
Mr. Chair.
Director.
Mr. Chair, it seemed that Representatives Hilty and Representative Mullery had some very specific questions in regards to predatory offender registration. And that seems to be a topic that we have pretty much every session. There's not a district in the state that doesn't deal with that. And so rather than have speculation or the old, I'll get back to you at a later date, I've brought along Special Agent in Charge Knutson, who actually runs the Predatory Offender Program for the BCA, and I'd like to have him address those questions, if I may.
Yes, sir. Will you go ahead and state your name and title, and go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Eric Knutson. I'm the Special Agent in Charge of the Crimes Against Persons Unit at the BCA.
Okay. Did you have a presentation you wanted to make?
I did not. Only I'd like to address the what I feel was the question, at least one of the questions that was related to the BCA in the last hearing last week. And that had to do with, I think, trying to forecast what the predatory offender population may be in future years. Obviously, a lot of that is predicated upon any statutes that might change from here forward. But I wanted to give you a little bit of a balance and idea. I think one of the statistics I had given Superintendent Bierger was with the increase in offender population throughout the year. And I think the stat that was given to this committee was about 120 to 140 new registrants a month come into the BCA for registration purposes on new offenders, which equates somewhere between 1,600 to 1,800 new offenders a year. One of the statistics we didn't talk about at that time were the offenders that come off the database or come off the rolls of registration throughout the year. So I've got some statistics that pertain to that. And I'd just like to go through those briefly, and if you have follow-up questions after that, I'd be happy to address those. But some of the other areas that we deal with in the predatory offender registration area are deceased offenders. And I took about a five-year snapshot or synopsis of how many offenders per year in a five-year period as a result of dying or being deceased come off the rolls. And it's about 90 a year for over a five-year period, actually, that we're no longer required to register. We also have another category. It's called inactive. Where we actually verify that offenders have moved to another state. We have mailed them a verification letter to that state. We have confirmed that they're now on the registration status for that state. So now we're no longer responsible for requiring registration in the state of Minnesota. And the average on that is about 270 offenders per year that we're no longer accountable and responsible for in the state of Minnesota.
Sir, on that one, a question. When we turn it over, do we annihilate the record of that individual, and is there any reciprocity? Say we shift one of those persons to another state or they move. Now it's their responsibility. Do they have the same responsibility as us? If they come back, will they notify us, or are they required to, so we can register them again?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, yes, we do have that agreement with those states. We notify them when the offender lets us know they're moving, and when states are informed by the offender that they're moving to Minnesota, we're also given that information.
Okay, thank you.
And the last category I have are the completed files. We actually have the majority of offenders have our 10-year requirement for registration. We also have several deviations from that. For most people, it's a 10-year minimum. Or the duration of their probation period, whichever is longer. But we also have lifetime registration now for over almost 3,500 registered offenders in the state of Minnesota. So we have about 560 offenders a year. Again, this is about a five-year average that come off of our registration rolls that actually complete their registration and are no longer required to fall under that statute.
Okay, any questions? Representative Mullery.
How many did you say per year come off?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, about five total. It's added up. It's between 850 and 900 offenders per year actually are no longer required to register or have completed their registration requirement or have deceased or are deceased.
And do you do we have the technology right now to? Is it already developed, or do we have the capability if we add on sex offenders onto the registration requirement, we up the numbers on the list? Does that make any problem for you and in the technology and keeping
Mr.
track
Chairman,
of
it? Committee members, we have some capacity for that. I guess it would make a tremendous difference on what numbers you're referring to. The other thing that wasn't mentioned last week, an omission on my part to pass on the superintendent, was we have a non-compliant website for the predatory offender registration offenders. And that website was enacted as a result of the legislative body here in 2006. And we have nearly 800 non-compliant offenders on that database right now. And those are offenders who have been non-compliant for over 30 days or over 16 years of age.
I've got a bill that we're going to drop in the hopper today that increases the number of sex offenders on the registration by quite a bit. I don't know if it's level 1 and 2. But so we'll probably be shipping you a fiscal note and asking you some questions if you can handle the upload.
Be happy to help any way we can, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think if I have the math straight in my head, with the figures that you just gave us, we're talking about a net increase of about 600 registrants a year. And the question that I raised and that you came to address is, what are the staffing implications? If that number is more or less correct and we're seeing an increase of about 600 per year, What are the staffing, the fiscal implications of that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, I think that 600 would be 600 per month. Be 600 new registrants per month. They could be per year, and the staffing is dictated a large part, Mr. Chairman, by the other variables that go with this. If it's decided that more of these registrants are going to be put on a website, and if more requirements are going to be mandated on these offenders as a result of some of these changes.
Good question, because I was just thinking more on the registration side. I'm not talking about staffing for probation or physical monitoring. I was talking about the public website for me. I don't know if anybody else had any questions about that, but I think just in general, I think the impetus behind it is the more and more sex offenses we hear about and the kids being snatched off the street or tried to, and all of a sudden somebody realizes somebody was living down the block. They get kind of mad when they didn't know, just because it was a certain level sex offender that they didn't know. So you get both sides of the argument. We had the Senate come in here last year that, or 2 years ago, I think it was Senator Shied, that basically wanted to make a jobs bill out of it, release offenders from prison early and cover up their records so to make it easier to get jobs. And you got every people on the other side that want to put everybody on the website. So it's an interesting conversation we'll have over the year, trying to figure out what the right medium is.
No, Mr. Chairman and committee members, one of the other statistics I brought are just to give you a number breakdown of the risk level of offenders, as Mr. Chairman is referring to. The risk level one offenders, these are offenders who have all been incarcerated in a state correctional facility. So they're not offenders who have actually served just jail time or probation. The risk level one are deemed the least likely to reoffend. We have about 3,700 risk level one offenders right now in the state of Minnesota. Level two offenders are deemed moderate likelihood to reoffend. Again, we have almost 1,700 level two offenders. And the level three are deemed the most likely to reoffend, and we have a little over 1,000 of those that are currently under a risk level three assignment.
Representative Mariani.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you, and I think you might have answered my question. I was trying to figure out what the recidivism factor is relative to any movement over time. I think you kind of indicated, or you shared with us how that breaks up per category, but overall, are we seeing a constant high recidivism rate, or are we talking about primarily new registered individuals relative to the growth, if you will, over time?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, we don't actually keep statistics on the recidivism rate. I have seen several studies that the Department of Corrections has run, and one of the unique things about recidivism is you're comparing, are they committing new sex offenses versus are they committing any new offense? So they actually have different levels of measurement when it regards to recidivism.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman and Agent Knutson, we'll get into the recidivism later and when bills come up, but on numbers right now, you said there's 1,000 level threes. I know that from experience in my community, the ones that come in, a lot of them end up violating some probation or supervision requirement. Are these 1,000 out in the community that are still level three registrants, or are some of those back in locked up someplace?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, no. Actually, there's about 650 of these 1,000 are actually locked up in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program and St. Peter or Minnesota Sex Offender Program and St. Peter or Moose Lake. So the majority of these level three offenders are not out in the community.
Representative Grunhagen first. Go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. What was your first name again?
Eric.
Yeah, Eric. Question, you know, on these sex offenders, I had one of the employees there from the St. Peter one that talked to me, and she indicated that the cost per day is over $300 a day, and I had a research department just looked that up, and I think they came up with 303 or 306 versus a regular inmate is, I believe, under $100 a day. So on these sex offenders, we're spending over $300 a day. And on a regular inmate, we're spending less than 100, is my understanding, unless you have a figure to correct that. But what's the reason for that extreme difference in cost?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunhagen. This was a discussion last legislative session when it came to budget issues, that the main difference is that the residents at St. Peter and Moose Lake are patients. They're not inmates. They're not incarcerated for any criminal violation. So they're actually receiving treatment from professionals while they're in while they're in those institutions.
So what is the difference? It's 300 and some dollars versus what's an inmate? What's the cost per day average in the state?
Mr. Chairman, you Representative Grunhagen, I do not have those numbers handy.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Grunhagen. We can probably get that answered when we get into the actual budget picture line by item by line item. And that we've been trying to figure out interesting names for them for years, clients, patients, and everything else. So I won't even go there. one thing we have to remember is, you know, we talk about recidivism. We're not talking about somebody just stealing the GPS off your dashboard. We're talking about people that might steal your son or daughter. And so recidivism takes on a whole different meaning when you're talking sex offenses. So you can't figure that. Sometimes we won't give a rip if a guy gets out of jail and comes back and commits a misdemeanor crime, but when these guys come back to commit a crime, even though the recidivism is low, it takes on a much larger importance, and it's a family member. Anybody else got any questions? All right. Thank you very much for your
Chairman
testimony.
Committee members, thank you.
Oh, and then Commissioner Ellison, if you want to come back up, Representative Leidiger has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually have just a couple of questions because, of course, a lot of us are new, and you probably know the answers to all these, but I'm going to ask a couple of these questions.
Go ahead.
First of all, and this kind of is a follow-up to Representative Grunhagen's question about using outsourcing a lot of the work. Commissioner Ellison, is there like an internal working group or an external working group in existence that you might know of that's looking at reorganizing your department, make it more efficient? And I ask that because the way I see it, and correct me if I'm wrong, the last time we had a major reorganization was probably when we launched the department of Homeland Security. That was probably the last time when you had a huge organization change going on within the department. And I'm just wondering now, since 2006, it looks like, have you had a chance to kind of look at the overall organization and now see if there are things that can be done from your perspective, either that you have found out or from this agency, if there is one, that you know, there's a direction that you can go to reorganize, tighten up the department, reduce the amount of spending, etc. I know that's a long-winded question, but do you get my drift on that question? I'm looking for an agency. Number one, do you have? I mean, is there a working group that's working on a reorganization that you know of,
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative. In terms of us looking internally at the department, I would say a couple of things. We expect our division directors and our management to be doing that on an ongoing basis. So we have performance measurements by statute that have to be provided to the legislature, and we do that. We do internal reorganization on a regular basis. That doesn't require a statutory change or replacing staff that aren't performing up to standards or looking at things within each of our divisions. In terms of a major reorganization, we would not presume to be making those recommendations publicly unless we have discussed them with Governor Dayton's office. So when Governor Dayton issues his budget, that is where you would see any sort of major reorganization that the governor might want to undertake. But we certainly wouldn't make those sorts of recommendations when we're in a transition period between one governor to the next.
Can I do a follow-up, please?
Representative Leidiger, go ahead.
one of the things in the back of my mind is I look at all the dollars coming from the federal government that pass through, and for instance, once again, the Department of Homeland Security. Those dollars go away. What do you do?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if those dollars go away, then we have to ask some really hard questions about what can we do with the dollars that are remaining, and then making you are aware, as legislators and the governor's office aware, there's a certain number of activities that will no longer be done.
Another follow-up question. And what percentage, rough figures, of the of federal dollars pass through compared to the state dollars that you have? I think you got $300 million state dollars.
Well, our total general fund dollars are $156,530,000 for the biennium. And our federal dollars total, I'm looking at my budget person here.
That's fine.
In terms of the federal dollars that we handle. We'll have to get the total number of federal dollars that we handle, but certainly we handle many more federal dollars than we do state dollars. So there would be a lot of activities that at the local level where we're passing federal money on to the local units of government, and they would have to make decisions then. Can they pick that up locally, or are they going to stop doing those activities? Those are the decisions that would be before us.
Okay. I think that's it. Thank you very much, Commissioner Ellison.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to clarify just one thing. I don't feel like we answered the question very well about transfers, the $69.8 million that we transferred.
Mr. Go ahead.
The other speakers were up here, just to clarify that, $60 million of that is the emergency communications networks, and those are monies that we collect from the 911 fees that we then transfer for bond, for payments on the bonds that are issued to build those systems. We transfer $4.25 million to other state funds, so other funds within state government. And then $4.7 million is the fire safety account that Director Rosendahl mentioned. $4.7 of that was transferred to the general fund.
Okay, thank you. Representative McDonald, go ahead.
I just want to share my appreciation to the Department of Public Safety, and in particular to Mr. Rosendahl. I just finished my tenure as a mayor for the city of Delano and was active in the Wright County Mayor's Association and very active in the fire department in those communities. And I understand and recognize the importance of the funding and the support that goes out to all the various fire departments. As you are probably aware, local cities are strapped in their budgets and helping support our fire departments, and they are certainly in need of many volunteers as well. A lot of them are suffering because of the lack of volunteers. It's a big time commitment. So I understand and recognize the importance of your department in helping fund and help increase the awareness, training, and updating equipment. It's very important, and I've seen it for the last 10 years in our communities, and appreciate it, and certainly will validate the important work that the fire marshal and their department does. And my kudos from Wright County to you and your department, and we look forward to working together. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
And Representative Mullery.
I just want to say we do have a federal number, and that's $233,907. That was the question of how much is federal versus state. So that's state versus $106 million in state money.
Okay, and Representative Leidiger, the federal government normally blackmails us with a lot of regulations, and if we don't do this and that with the federal money, they're going to take it away. And with that blackmail, hopefully, comes a guarantee of some type in the future that we're going to get continued funding, because like the stimulus money, if that ever drops off, then we're in a world of hurt if we can't cover the gap. So, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the stimulus money is going to drop off, unfortunately. Question on the BCA lab. I don't know if you were going to cover that or not, but if you're not, or anyhow, the questions are, we're a city or county. I know some cities and counties have their own labs, like St. Paul, I believe, Minneapolis, Hennepin County. I think there's just two state labs, if I remember right. How does that affect do those cities then, and they're doing it because they can't get the results back in time for investigations and trials from the state. So does that affect, do they get some kind of a compensation back from the state for the fact that they're not getting the use of the state facility? And also, if there are local charge, or if locals are charged for use of each test or something at the BCA, do they, is there some way that they have to pay the overall extra costs, not just for that test, but for proportion of the fact that some of the counties and cities are taking up a lot of the burden? How does that work for offsetting those costs to the communities that are paying what the state should be doing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, I'll answer it in a broad sense, and I'm going to ask Superintendent Bjerga to you know, pencil in the details here. But we have, it's true that there are some local labs that have developed. I think what's happened in the laboratory community as a whole is that there's been some triage that local units of government have handled some cases versus cases that are handled at the BCA. So there's been some internal priorities in terms of who handles what types of cases. So I'll say that. I think the negative part that's happened is that local units of government typically pay higher wages than the state agencies pay. So what happens is that it takes several years to train a forensic scientist. And we have invest a lot, the state invests a lot of dollars in training those people. So what happens when a local lab starts up, they start cherry picking some of the scientists that we've spent time training at the BCA, and so that again hurts us. Then we train somebody and we can't pay what local units of government pay, and then local units of government pick up that person. So there's some of that going on that is not having a positive impact from our perspective. With that, I'd ask Superintendent Bjerga to talk more about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, I'm not aware of any agencies that we charge for forensic laboratory services. That's new to me, I guess. Secondly, in response to local labs, while the turnaround time within our agency may have been a factor, I think a lot of the reason behind local labs is just, frankly, more local control. And their cases then are always prioritized. We get a lot of requests at our laboratory to prioritize cases for different jurisdictions based on emergency needs or whatnot. And I think that there are some jurisdictions around the state that just felt like they would prefer to have more local control over what's examined and the kind of time that it takes. Just to touch on what Commissioner Ellison said in regards to staff leaving the BCA for some of the for the local labs, it takes a considerable amount of time to train a new forensic scientist to the point where that person is working on their own and has the ability to testify in court, anywhere from 1 to 3 years. And since the local labs have started up, they're of course looking for the best people, just like we all are. And we have had that occur where we've had some people hired away from us for a variety of reasons. But it is just something that we have to deal with.
Mr. Chairman, then just kind of summarize, it seems to me, unless this is inaccurate, it seems that St. Paul, Minneapolis, whoever else has them around, really doesn't get anything back for the fact that they're doing a lot of the state's business, and it seems like to me. I mean, we can talk about their, we do some costs of training, but as a general, then they don't get anything back for what we should be doing for them. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would actually frame that differently. I think that the local governments have decided that they're willing to pay for their own labs even though there is a state lab available. So they're making a proactive decision to invest in that because they want their cases to be higher priority cases than other cities or counties.
Mr. Chairman, we can argue, but I think my statement's correct.
You know, I am Representative Mullery, I probably surprisingly taking an opposite position than you in that one, but personally, we'll have this discussion, but for the edification of the junior members here that haven't been here before, we've had discussion a lot about how many labs we should have and where they're located. The problem is everybody wants their own lab. Everybody wants their own fire training center. Everybody wants their own police training center. They want their own little kingdom. And we can't afford to make them all. And personally, I'd like to seal them right where they're at now. And I'm not a big fan of creating more labs. When we take the tour of the BCA, you'll see it's an impressive unit. I'd rather put our funding into that. And I've never had any problems shipping up all sorts of evidence to the BCA and getting it back on time from the little town of Lake Crystal and with good results, whether it's forensic testing or fingerprinting or whatever it is. But like I say, there's a viable argument the other way too, and you talk about time and energy, but with all the time and energy it takes to produce a forensic scientist, like you say, and the beautiful facility we have there, it's hard to justify expending new money to putting out, especially this budget cycle and the next one. So, but I sure welcome that conversation and the various points of view on this. I'm just one of a bunch of members here. So, anybody else got any questions for Mr. Bierga?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I didn't go through all the slides for the BCA because there was a rather extensive hearing the other day on the BCA. So unless you want me to go through them, I'm happy to do that again. But it's up to the committee.
No, that's fine. I think we're okay.
Then
we
that
got out a little early. And
then that completes our testimony.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Unless you have questions.
Director, and it's been good having you here. And we'll sure have you back once we get into the line by line and find out where all the money's going. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
And now the GOPO members are going to retire for pizza, and it's your duty now that you have to mirror all our events and pay for pizza for your members. We're going to go plot and scheme. Thank you all for coming today. And next meeting will be, where is my agenda? This is it? Tomorrow, January 19th, 10:15, and the Peace Officer Standards of Training Board and Department of Corrections are going to be up in front of us. And anybody have any final comments or questions? Yes, Representative Mullen.
Mr. Chairman, that mentioning post just got me into looking over, and I have one more question for.
We have a kind of quiet out there for a while you're leaving. Go ahead.
I noticed that in some of the budgets, there's for training police, and then how do they distinguish why some gets money going through BCA for training police and some goes to the post board for training police, and how does that all work out? I just thought, unless they're going to be here tomorrow and can discuss it with the post board.
I think what Representative Mullery is asking is that this money, some of the money that goes from the surcharge goes to the post board and goes out on a prorate, how many officers each department has, and depending how much money to fund, they get that back for a reimbursement to each department. But there's a separate fund that goes to you, and you put on your own BCA training, which officers go to, and how are those two funds distinguished? And where do you get your money from? Do you put on the training statewide? Say, when we get a bullet that says BCA is going to provide training on domestic abuse or harassment and restraining orders, and we go in, where do you get that dough?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we charge a fee to the police agency for the training that we provide. We do get a small general fund allocation for that division, but most of the funding for the training is paid for by the agency of the officer that's attending. And so then that agency or that officer can use the post board money that they're being provided for training if they want to attend the training at the BCA. I think we did go through a lot of that last week, but we could certainly have people come back, talk up specifically about training. I know they did talk a little bit about training.
I know for our department, thank you, Commissioner, we get a form from the post board, and we fill out all the classes and officers and hours that we sent. We send it to the post board, and then depending on how much money they have, they send you back an amount. They divvy up the funds statewide, and you get per officer an amount out of that pot.
So, Mr. Chairman, the post, I thought they did it, some of the training themselves, but do they just use then BCA for all training?
Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think post does any training. They monitor the training. They put out model policies as far as putting on training. The only training they put on is in their own staff. They monitor and put out the policies. and then we get our training. It does. We can get private training. We can get training from the South Central College. We can get it from the BCA, Feds, wherever we get the training. If it costs us money, we can get reimbursed through that post fund. So is that about right, here, yes. Mr. Carter?
Just one question,
Representative Mullery.
Who's in charge of coordinating that type of training or certifying the training? Is that them or the post board or?
Well, as far as I know, the post board has to approve the courses for content and lesson plans. You send them your lesson plan, they send approval back, and then you're allowed to give it, and they check on how many credits it's really worth and the content and approve it. So,
thank you.
Any other questions or comments? If not, meeting adjourned. See you tomorrow.